Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between our personal health and well-being and what's going on with our food, water, air, earth, our health, our food, our environment, our communities, as well as all the public policies that shape whether we have a healthy environment and a healthy society and a well-balanced earth or not so much because of things that we choose to do as businesses and as a society and with our public policies. So every week on Connect the Dots, that's what we talk about. For the last 3 months, we've been covering secret deals, global trade agreements. And week after week on this show, we've had a variety of guests from different public interests, environmental, food, trade, labor, social justice, and other groups, letting us know the problems with what we were describing as soon-coming secret trade deals that were going to be fast-tracked through the Senate and Congress. We've been warning you they were coming. We were telling you what is of concern, all of the different guests that have appeared on the program. Now they're here, and so we're going to update where we are this week with fast-track, the rushing through of the deals poised to go through the Senate in the coming week, and then moving on from there to the House. And we also counsel you how to participate and take action. On today's show, I'm really thrilled to have not one but two outstanding guests, and we're going to be talking about food. Dave Murphy has been a frequent guest on Connect the Dots over the years. He's the founder and executive director of Food Democracy Now, a grassroots movement of more than 650,000 American farmers and citizens dedicated to reforming policies related to food, agriculture, and the environment. Dave has been called the most crucial and political savvy actor in the ongoing efforts to help move American agriculture into the 21st century. And he's been on the show a great deal because of his incredible leadership and activism in the anti-GMO movement. Joining him is a guest that we've had on the show week after week as we've been covering these trade deals, Adam Weissman, a terrific organizer from New York with Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, an organization that addresses the threat posed by free trade agreements to animals, the environment, safe, ethical, and sustainable food, and the human rights of environmental defenders. Adam also represents Global Justice for Animals and the Environment in Trade Justice New York Metro, a coalition of organizations from diverse social justice and environmental movements working together. So today we're going to be talking with these two leaders in raising awareness and providing avenues for activism and influence by the people on public policy as the president has come forward with, you know, fast-tracking, which means basically rushing through Congress, the decision about whether he can rubber-stamp trade agreements without their contents being transparent and known to the general public, and with even Congress having only minimal access to them under the circumstances in which they are allowed to view these materials, which is kind of in a deep, secure dungeon where they can't even take notes about hundreds of pages of legalese. Nevertheless, these two experts, through leaks, are privy to a lot of the language of the agreements, and on today's show, they'll be interpreting for you listeners and me, and I'm waiting with bated breath to hear them, what these provisions are and how they will influence the food supply. So welcome so much to Connect the Dots, both of you, Dave Murphy and Adam Weissman.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah. Now, listen, one of the things I think that's been obscure, you know, I talk to a lot of people who are foodies, who are concerned about health, they're concerned about healthy nutrition. And, you know, I'll frequently say these deals are going to have if they are allowed to pass, if they are fast-tracked and then signed by the president, they're going to have, you know, a real negative impact on our food supply, our food options, the quality of food we get, our ability to know what's in our food. You know, let's begin, Dave, with you. You've been looking at the provisions. What are, just give us like your first top concern in terms of what you see in the provisions and how that's going to affect food if these deals are signed.
Well, thank you again, Allison. Thank you for having me on the show and also for your great work that you've been covering this. And also, Adam, as an activist, you've done a great job in getting the word out there, mobilizing people. You know, I think when you look at trade agreements, it's very boring. A lot of people's eyes glaze over. And I'll just say, you know, NAFTA, most people, it was sold to us by Bill Clinton, and it was adopted by Republicans and Wall Street Democrats. And in a lot of ways, NAFTA is responsible for gutting America's manufacturing. It cost an estimated 700,000 jobs and basically gutted America's manufacturing, shipped overseas. And if that was a job-killing trade agreement in the 1990s, the TPP and the TTIP are both, with Europe, are basically democracy-killing trade agreements. There's in this, in there is the investor-state dispute settlement clause or provision, which allows corporations to sue governments if they pass a law, environmental protection law or consumer protection law, that quote unquote would cost a company profits. And I would just say this has been a very secretive process for 5 years. 600 corporate lobbyists have been working behind the scenes to jam pack this full of every corporate handout they could think of in corporate giveaway. And I would just say the investor state dispute settlement provision is extremely dangerous. It's a democracy, representative democracy ending provision. And it's already been used multiple times by large corporations. And I know Barack Obama and the White House may want to dispute this, but there's a hilarious segment on John Oliver. I think it's this week, last week, tonight. I'm not sure the name of the show, that covers how the tobacco industry has used investor state dispute settlement provisions to sue Australia and other governments who passed basically plain packaging rules on cigarettes. But for me, there's no real agreement that's been seen publicly except for what was passed 2.5 weeks ago by the Senate Finance Committee, and it's called the Bipartisan Congressional Trade Priorities and Accountability Act of 2015. So this is the only document that the American public has been allowed to be seen, and this is basically the trade provision authority, the fast track that Congress has to pass before to give the White House fast track so they can finalize these negotiations. And I'll just say for anyone that cares about food transparency, what's in their foods, the real concerning thing about these trade agreements is they're trying to quote-unquote harmonize the laws, and they're trying to break down barriers. So governments can't protect them from Americans' toxic chemicals or toxic products. And on page 9 of this Bipartisan Congressional Trade Priorities and Accountability Act, there is page 9 that says, it calls labeling of genetically engineered foods is considered an unjustified trade restriction. And it says, you know, there should be no past unjustified trade restrictions or commercial requirements such as labeling that affect new technologies, including biotechnology. So this would mean that the labeling movement here in the U.S. that has been fighting, you know, labeling, these ballot initiatives that have gone through and that have not passed in California, Washington, Oregon, and Colorado, they spent $100 million to stop us. We've passed GMO labeling bills in 3 states, Vermont, Connecticut, and Maine. What this would do would basically could possibly undo the European standard of labeling genetically engineered foods, because it says that labeling of biotech products is an unjustified trade restriction. And if you ask me, that's an outrage. And it's exactly the reason that this process is so secretive. But there are handouts like this to every single industry, pharmaceutical, oil industry. They can all use the investor state dispute settlement clause to sue any state or local government and national government. It's really an outrage and a loss of sovereignty for representative democracy.
So what does that mean? You know, you and Food Democracy Now! Have been very involved in the balloting initiatives in different states. listeners who are unfamiliar with this, you can look up in the Connect the Dots archives. We've done past programs on this and updated listeners all throughout the process on several years' worth of wins and losses and everything. You came incredibly close in the last cycle election in 2014, you know, losing that by a mere 800-some-odd votes. After a recount and everything, so it was so close. These corporations poured $25 million, in television ads in order to kind of confuse and mislead Oregonian voters, because there were many more people who were confused by these ads that might have voted to label the foods, as we detailed in a program that we did last winter with Lisa Stocky, your compatriot there at Food Democracy Now. Every day I see, different things going on that, that states are trying to do or localities are trying to do, and it's terrific that this is advancing. But, it seems like, from what you're saying, that if these trade deals were passed, this would have a terribly chilling effect on even passing new bans, new labeling initiatives, on all of the local activities that, everyone is turning to in order to get a better handle here in the U.S. on our food supply.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. These trade agreements are an absolute disaster. They're negotiated behind closed doors. The American public or any citizenry of any country is not allowed to review the clauses or participate in the conversation. And I think what really outrages a lot of us, beyond the fact that, in a democracy, you should have open and transparent debate. Your elected officials, we have a representative democracy. We elect people to go, and they say certain things during the election process that they're going to follow through on. And then we hope that they'll do that in elected office. But usually there's a debate, an ongoing debate in a democratic society. And these, the TTP trade agreements, and the fast track is a disastrous result of denying that. And for people that care about food and labeling of genetically engineered foods, people want labeling for a variety of reasons. But really, when I look at the GMO process, what genetically engineered foods are, they're basically a toxic chemical delivery device. Over 90% of them have been genetically engineered to survive the spraying of Roundup, which the World Health Organization recently declared as a probable carcinogen. So what would happen is I think Colombia has already said that they will ban the use of Roundup or glyphosate in their country. Other countries are going to follow through with this very quickly. Any state or county that passed this could actually be sued, passed a ban on Roundup or glyphosate, which is a probable carcinogen. They could actually be forced to pay profit losses to Monsanto or to another company that produces glyphosate. And there's bans that were passed in Jackson County on GMOs, Jackson County, Oregon, and Josephine County last year, and also in Maui County in Hawaii. And those can be overturned by the investor state dispute settlement provisions.
Let me turn the conversation now and get Adam's input on this. Adam Weissman, what I hear is, a lot of food groups are, this can't possibly be. We've heard President Obama denying it and saying anyone who says that anything in the trade deals that, could tell us how to regulate or what our laws should be, anyone who construes the deal as having the kind of authority to do that, that Dave is describing here, doesn't understand. They won't possibly have that effect. There's no way that could happen. The president has issued that kind of denial, and a lot of people are kind of feeling, well, the president, said that this couldn't possibly be a risk of these deals. What do you have to say about that?
President Obama has, since 2007, established a record as a person who does not tell the truth about trade policy. He goes back on his own word, he makes false statements, and he has given every reason for people to not see him as someone who is fundamentally trustworthy on this issue. You can look at the legacy of trade agreements that President Obama himself supported and signed into law as clear examples of exactly why these trade policies are so destructive. As an example, in 2007, Barack Obama was only one of two candidates in the Democratic primary who supported the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement. There were, at that point, 9 candidates in the Democratic field. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were the only 2 who supported this agreement. This is an agreement that, at the time, human rights groups and environmental groups warned would have devastating impacts on the country of Peru, that labor groups argued would create significant setbacks for workers in Peru, and which, across the board, people said would create no real benefits for the United States. Well, sure enough, after that agreement, which Obama supported, went into effect, we saw a series of massacres of Peru, first of farmers who were concerned about how opening the floodgates for U.S. subsidized genetically modified pesticide sprayed crops would destroy their local traditional agriculture, and asked for government subsidies so that they could remain competitive against U.S. exports. And then a year later, of indigenous people who were facing the confiscation of their land under a legislative decree pushed by the president of Peru under the guise of implementing the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement. The same kind of investor provisions that we're talking about here have already been used to disastrous effect in the case of that very agreement that Obama supported. There's a case right now in Peru where a U.S. investor by the name of Ira Rennert has a company called Renco, which has a Peruvian subsidiary, which owns a metal smelter site which has been classified as one of the 10 most toxic sites in the world. A Peruvian court has ruled repeatedly that they're obligated to clean up that site. They asked for an extension on remediation once. They asked for an extension on and were granted it. They asked for an extension on remediation twice and were granted it. The third time around, the Peruvian court finally said they could not get another extension. So they brought an investor case for $800 million against the country of Peru for having the audacity to demand that they clean up this toxic site. So that was the first agreement that Obama supported. Then in 2008, as a candidate, he insisted that he was going to, as president, use the hammer of an opt-out, in his words, to bring Mexico and Canada to the table in order to renegotiate NAFTA. Well, at that time, it was revealed that one of his advisors, Austin Goolsbee, was up in Canada advising the Canadian government that this was just campaign rhetoric and he didn't actually mean it. And that actually leaked and it hurt him in that primary. Sure enough, once he clinched the Democratic nomination, he was quoted in an interview as saying that his talk about NAFTA during the primary had just been overheated campaign rhetoric and that, you know, he didn't actually mean that stuff about renegotiating NAFTA. So after he won the presidency for about a year, he didn't do much on trade, but then turned around and pushed 3 trade agreements that had been left over by the Bush administrations, trade agreements that the Bush administration had negotiated and hadn't been able to get through Congress while President Bush was in office. So President Obama, who had spoken out vocally against 2 of those trade agreements, the trade agreement with Colombia, the country with the worst human rights record in the Western Hemisphere, a country where over 3,000 labor organizers have been assassinated since the 80s, and the trade agreement with South Korea that the President Obama warned would have detrimental effects on U.S. workers, particularly in the auto and beef industries, but that observers warned of a far wider range of effects than that in terms of deregulating the financial industry, outsourcing U.S. jobs, putting our environmental rules on the chopping block. So Obama came into office and put a little Band-Aid on the Colombia agreement with a side agreement that was supposed to address some labor concerns, really wasn't effective and everyone knew it wouldn't be, addressed none of the other wide-ranging human rights concerns in Colombia, like the forced displacement of indigenous and Afro-Colombian communities, and then cut a deal specifically and narrowly on beef and autos with Korea. Interestingly, a deal that directly goes against his agenda as someone who says he wants to address climate change, given that, first of all, we know that the global trade in beef and the global increasing rate of beef consumption is a driver of climate change, and exporting cheaper beef around the world is certainly not going to address that. But even more specifically, one of the things that he did with autos to try to give a boost to the U.S. auto industry was specifically pushing Korea to lower their CAFE standards on cars, meaning allowing more gas-guzzling cars into Korea rather than raising our standards to greater fuel efficiency and thus climate-friendlier cars. He pushed Korea to lower their standards to allow U.S. imports.
So, Adam, that actually sounds, I mean, I'm getting two major points there from what you're saying. One is that he has, a lot of people are probably, very puzzled saying, why is this Obama's legacy? he must be, you know, misinformed about this. He couldn't possibly be doing it. But what you're pointing out is that with all of these previous things that he's been pushing for, this is very much his legacy. It's just something that, you know, many people haven't been paying attention to. And in fact, this is consistent with what he's tried to do all along, which was enforce these corporate rules and empowerment over the rights of people to their land, to their food, to you know, to live in a toxic free environment, to the industries in their area. He has been consistently, from your telling of this, you know, on the side that we see him on now, but it wasn't something that, you know, the average person was paying a lot of attention to. What you're also saying is that he is, you know, basically lowering standards, consistently bringing standards down from safer standards, you know, that people would need or that would protect health, food, or the environment. He's been consistently lowering those kinds of standards in order to increase industry profits and all the rest of it, and that also has been consistent. How do you see that playing out in terms of food? How will, you know, what parts of these agreements are going to really have, you know, Dave has mentioned the investor state dispute resolution. Are there other provisions in the treaties that you see as having, you know, a leveling, lowering effect on the quality of food or access to healthy food or the labeling of food?
Yes, there are a bunch. One is for those of us who support the idea of local food and promoting, keeping our food supply local and supporting local farmers. These trade agreements will include provisions that prohibit government procurement rules that benefit local business. So, for example, let's say we want to pass, let's say New Jersey wanted to pass a Jersey Fresh Produce Ordinance saying that for New Jersey government, for Jersey schools, for Jersey government programs that are purchasing food, they will prefer New Jersey farmers to try to promote the idea of supporting local food. That could actually be prohibited under this agreement as discriminating against foreign food producers. So if we're actually trying to cut the carbon miles of our food and promote local agriculture, that could actually be something that would be subject to attack. We're not allowed, New Jersey's not allowed to prefer New Jersey tomatoes to tomatoes half a world away. As another example is the recently leaked regulatory cooperation chapter of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the deal between the U.S. and Europe, and there's a similar chapter in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is one of the chapters that really gives the lie to the idea that these agreements are about cutting bureaucracy and about deregulation and about free trade, because actually what this will do is create a whole new bureaucracy, a new agency that is unelected, that is not a part of our specific governments, but that is this whole new bureaucracy that stands in the way of individual nations passing their own laws and will basically force countries to have their laws evaluated in terms of how they will affect corporate profits. And just a quote about that leak, and this is something that was just leaked last month, and we really see here why they shut the public out of these things and why there's this high level of secrecy, because every time we actually see what's in these things, they're more and more damning. Friends of the Earth Europe, commenting on this new leak, said that the Commission proposal introduces a system that puts every new environmental, health, and labor standard at Europe and member state level at risk. It creates a labyrinth of red tape for regulators to be paid by the taxpayer that undermines their appetite to adopt legislation in the public interest. One of the areas that we're really concerned about through these trade agreements is their attack on the precautionary principle, on the whole idea that we should be able, that a valid science-based standard for regulation is saying that we should be able to prohibit and restrict categories of products that we don't know the full effect of yet, that we shouldn't treat the entire, our planet and our own health as laboratory experiments, and that we should have the data first before we release dangerous chemicals into the environment. That the case against the precautionary principle is being used by chemical companies and pesticide companies and other companies that want to not have their dangerous chemicals adequately studied and regulated. One particular area of concern that relates directly back to our good friends at Monsanto, as well as other chemical and quote-unquote life sciences companies, is the use of neonicotinoid pesticides. And these are pesticides that have been linked to bee die-offs that they don't want studied and that they don't want regulated. There are also concerns Dave mentioned before about rules around food technologies. GMOs are only one of the emerging food technologies that people want more data on before we want applied to our foods. Another example is nano coatings, these tiny particle coatings that have effects that we don't even yet fully understand, but some of the early data on is quite disturbing, that are already being applied to some of our foods without our knowledge. And so this is a way to really get these agreements through these chapters like the regulatory coherence chapter, through efforts at what's called sanitary and phytosanitary harmonization, meaning creating one set of universal rules between the participating countries, are really designed to create a race to the bottom, to create a flat level of the lowest possible regulations across the board, and really a lowest common denominator approach, rather than what we've been promised, which is high standards trade agreements, which would really mean raising standards so that we have the highest standards across the board. Instead of creating opportunities for the European for the U.S. factory farm industry to attack European food safety and animal welfare regulations, instead pushing the U.S. to raise our standards to European levels, so that when Europe objects to the U.S. Chlorine washing poultry, and the U.S. brings a World Trade Organization case to shove chlorine washed poultry literally down Europeans' throats, the U.S., instead of Europe being in a position of potentially having to pay trade concessions to the U.S. for not wanting to accept chlorine washed poultry or not wanting to accept hormone treated beef, another WTO case, the U.S. will actually be the one in the position of having to raise standards for the benefit of consumers across the board. Another concern is inspection. These agreements are designed to encourage participating countries to treat their food inspection standards as equivalent, even if their actual food rules are not equivalent. The U.S. will see a flood of increased imports under these trade agreements. We will not see an increase in the number of actual inspectors, and will be encouraged to treat inspections overseas as equivalent to ones done here. And this is in light of this is despite the fact that some of the countries involved in these agreements have food safety standards that are lower than our own and have very questionable records. Two clear examples: Vietnam and Malaysia both are major exporters of factory shrimp, of farmed shrimp. Both of them have notable records of exporting toxic shrimp. Vietnam has a record of exporting shrimp from shrimp farms that are contaminated with pesticides. Malaysia exports shrimp that's transshipped from China, also known for toxic shrimp. So we really are putting the safety of consumers at risk in the interest of corporate profits through these trade deals.
Thank you, Adam. That's a terrific, terrific summary. Dave Murphy, Food Democracy Now!, you know, you work very closely with farmers and agriculture, and, you know, coming right from, you know, the Grain Belt and everything in the Midwest, as well as all your work internationally. I mean, if on the one hand our standards aren't raised, and on the other hand we're adopting lower standards of other food suppliers from other nations and can't either label that these foods are coming from where they're coming from, where they're kind of health risks of contamination that Adam detailed, but also purely economically, you know, what happens to American farmers, what happens to the American economy if we have like this flood of lower grade food flooding our borders without proper inspections? What is this going to do to, you know, the economy of American farming and agriculture?
Sure. Well, I think Adam made a lot of great points. And first of all, going back historically, what these trade agreements have done, NAFTA is a perfect lesson. We already know that NAFTA forced 2 million farmers, Mexican farmers, off the land. So if Republicans and quote-unquote business, the business party of business, the Republican Party, wants to complain about immigration and problems with, you know, quote-unquote illegal aliens, what they really should do is look at these trade agreements. Because forcing 2 million farmers off the land in Mexico, you took away their way of making a living for their family. So they were desperate. They've come to the streamed in the United States to find jobs so they can feed their family. what happens, you know, these bills, they always sound very innocuous when they're passed. And I'll just say there's the people, the reason you should oppose these agreements is because the people that are for it, and the people that are for it in agriculture are like Farm Bureau, the pork producers and the poultry growers. They all, listen, as, you know, Adam was talking about these and no inspection of shrimp in Vietnam and Malaysia. We don't inspect them anyway. There's very low inspection of these. They already are streaming in. I think this would lower that even further. And another thing that was brought up was about nanotech. So the one concerning thing is Adam brought up sanitary and phytosanitary. These are legalistic terms. They are really a race to the bottom. They want to harmonize the rules. Basically, it means that any corporation, this is the biggest global corporate handout in the history of humanity. And one of the things is, and I'm going to refer back to the document that I've been reading with great interest, and because this is a sneak peek of the disaster that's coming. But on page 6 of this Bipartisan Congressional Trade Priorities and Accountability Act of 2015, which Democratic Senator Ron Wyden and Republican Orrin Hatch, Ron Wyden from Oregon and Orrin Hatch from Utah, they brokered this deal 3 weeks ago in April, and it says on page 6, basically, to encourage the adoption of international standards and require a science-based justification to be provided. My question really is, who is this adoption of international standards? Who's going to write those international standards? Well, we already know that Monsanto and Syngenta and DuPont, these giant, you know, chemical companies that now produce our food, they're going to be the ones that write the standards. And they also are going to say they want to improve regulatory coherence, appropriately recognize the equivalent of health and safety protection systems of exporting countries. So here, this is the actual language on page 6 of the Bipartisan Congressional Trade Priority Accountability Act that is going to do what Adam said it will. Basically, it's going to recognize countries' flawed inspection systems and force us to adopt them. But more importantly, what they're going to try to do with the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the European equivalent, the TTIP, is they're going to force these countries to adopt our non-existent scientific regulatory rules, which have allowed, you know, Monsanto's GMOs to be proliferated all over. So based in Iowa, basically 97% of soybeans grown in Iowa are genetically engineered, 93% of corn. This has been an environmental disaster. Talking about neonicotinoids, they're linked to massive bee die-offs. Over 50% of bees have died in the last 6 years, and that's only increasing. There's new studies that are coming out every day linking it to neonicotinoid pesticides. And already Bayer and Syngenta are trying to sue Europe and England for banning them, for a temporary ban, while studies, research is being done. But I want to talk about, so what's going to happen to farmers in the Midwest? What, there already has been a race to the bottom with the explosion of factory farms. And one of the provisions that passed, one of the laws that passed in Iowa in 1996, was a thing called local control. They stripped local control from county level officials to have a say that they could ban or not build a factory farm in a certain area. Now, our good friend, Secretary Vilsack, Tom Vilsack, he was a state senator at that time. He then moved up to governor, but he helped broker the compromise on this. And in 15 years, we lost over 80% of the hog farmers in Iowa, which had previously formed the backbone of our rural economy. Now that's gone. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is not going to open up. It's not going to open up a lot of additional markets for U.S. exports in a way that's going to provide farmers a living. It's going to provide Cargill more money. It's not going to and Smithfield and Tyson more money. It's not going to provide farmers an increased and a better life, you know, way of life or better livelihood. There'll be no economic benefit for your average farmer in the Midwest.
And then if the farmers are hurting, that hurts our economy. In addition, it hurts our access to food. It means that the food that's coming is energy intensive in terms of having to travel all over the place. I mean, here we are trying to limit fossil fuel use, and instead, you know, you have this wonderful thing of all these food and products going all over the world, ignoring the fact that we are, you know, spending fossil fuels to get them there. So even, you know, how does the food and agriculture, the changes that this will do to food and agriculture, how does that impact the environment? You know, either of you that would like to speak about this, what will be the environment, you know, the climate change price tag, the hidden, you know, unevaluated cost of this, of using fossil fuels to, you know, and outsourcing our food and hitting on our economy in this way and undermining the U.S. economy through undermining U.S. farmers. How is all of that also going, what is the environmental impact of that going to be in terms of accelerating climate change? I don't expect that you all would have figures on that, you know, to offer, but, you know, what are we looking at in terms of general projections about the impact of that, and is that being considered?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I think, I'm sorry, go ahead, Dave.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. One thing that I think is really notable is that at the same time that we're seeing new federal nutrition regulation recommendations being developed saying that in order to address climate change, we need to shift towards more plant-based diets, we're at the same time seeing our government pushing a trade policy that is largely backed by the big meat industry, and with the idea of creating increased market access, driving up consumer demand by exporting cheaper products and entering more and more products, shifting more and more of the world towards a Western diet that is heavy in animal products and processed foods, at the expense of a diet that is heavier in that is higher in the things that people should be eating more of, which are fruits and vegetables. We've already seen in Mexico the devastating health effects of NAFTA, where since the passage of NAFTA, Mexican diets have shifted more in this U.S. direction of white flour, processed foods, and animal products. And we've seen, as a result, increasing rates of obesity and increasing rates of diseases like diabetes and other diseases directly linked to this destructive diet that we have in the U.S. And these diets are, of course, not only destructive to our own health, but our planet's health. Ruminant livestock, meat products in particular, are devastating to global climate. And if we look at the countries involved in TPP, we see major producers of three of the food products that have been most directly linked to climate change, beef, of course, but also sheep products, which are even more GHG intensive. And finally, and perhaps most surprisingly, worse than both beef and sheep products is farmed shrimp, which we've already mentioned before. Farmed shrimp is just about the most GHG intensive food on the planet. And that is
something that will... What is GHTM?
Greenhouse gas intensive products on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
When we're seeing a shift to more and more, we're going to see a shift to more and more cheap and available and dangerous, by the way, farmed shrimp. So this is one major environmental impact. We're also going to see, as we have seen with past trade agreements, more and more of a shift towards concentration of agriculture, more factory farms, more genetically modified and pesticide sprayed crops over traditional agriculture. One of the major effects of Mexico was the loss of livelihoods for about 5 million people involved in agriculture jobs. And mostly these were people involved in traditional, local, sustainable agriculture, as those jobs were replaced by the flood of U.S. exports from our destructive, corporatized, industrialized agriculture system. So more and more of the world's food supply is going to be supplied by this very unsustainable but high-yield and cheap agriculture system that is poisoning our land and water with pesticides, that is releasing dangerous genetically modified crops into our environment. We're also going to see an increase in shift towards grain-fed livestock and to feed more and more world demand, and which, of course, grain-fed livestock is tied to deforestation, as forests are in regions like the Amazonas, forests are clear-cut to produce livestock feed. So more and more unsustainable food being produced in more and more unsustainable ways is really the corporate agenda of free trade, and is something we need to be very concerned about. In terms of public health, we also need to look at the link between free trade, industrialized food, deregulation, and foodborne illness. Things like the so-called NAFTA flu, which where Smithfield Farms decided they didn't like the regulations on factory farms that they were facing in the United States. So they decided it would be a marvelous idea after NAFTA to produce pork south of the border and under lower regulatory conditions. And as a result, in Veracruz, Mexico, at a filthy factory farm called Carroll Ranches, suddenly the local community came down with a strange and virulent flu that spread. And we eventually came to call swine flu. The pork industry quickly, in a public relations move, insisted on pushing for calling that H1N1, which was their major response, not dealing with the fact that their unsustainable and dangerous production practices were causing mass deaths. Something like 18,000 people suffered as a result of that disease outbreak, Asia as well, there in some of the countries directly involved in TPP and in the past Korea agreement, there's been an increased spread in diseases like bird flu and swine flu passing through some of these countries. So first of all, it's not just moving factory farms into deregulated environments. It's also the passage back and forth of livestock, of contaminated food products, and the shift away from less dangerous forms of agriculture towards more dangerous forms of agriculture, where when you cram lots of livestock into tight conditions, when you create superbugs by preemptively feeding lots of antibiotics to livestock, you create the conditions that make dangerous diseases inevitable.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very vivid picture of, you know, the destructiveness of going down this direction, Adam. And you know, and thank you so much. I mean, Dave, you know, I just have to ask because, you know the food movement. You've been active and organized in the food movement, the consumer food movement, you know, and people moving into action and activism and policy, as I have as a reporter. And, you know, the truism that I so often hear is like, you know, you're as consumers, a lot of people, I mean, the GMO labeling movement has been an exceptional success in galvanizing millions of people, health-conscious people, food-conscious people, and getting them on their feet and acting on public policy, where, you know, across the board in all of the food and health areas, there is not another success like it that one can point to and say, well, this really got people going and people are up in arms and they're really, you know, pressuring their public officials. They're wanting to, you know, stand up and get engaged as citizens. I mean, it's just been an exceptional thing. And so I really, you know, think that you and the other, you know, food groups like Organic Consumers and others, you know, have been in the forefront of this, have just done an incredible mobilization job. But, you know, one of the truisms in the health and food area that, you know, you and I both come from is vote with your dollars. You know, we buy the foods that we like, I mean, you know, and then this sends a message and we can build these healthy food industries, and then gradually these other companies will, you know, they'll their stocks will go down, their sales will decrease, you know, and they'll get the message and have to kind of fold up shop, and that's why they're so threatened by healthy food growers and consumers. That's why they don't want labeling, etc. But, you know, in this context where, you know, you have this playing field tilted with these treaties coming in, you know, will consumers have the ability to vote with their dollars? Will they have the choice to choose healthy foods? Will those foods be grown? Will they be available? Will people know what foods they're eating? You know, will that whole prescription for making social change through consuming healthy foods still be as possible and as much of an option as it has been, you know, before we have these global treaties coming in and making, you know, globalizing the kinds of changes that these earlier agreements show show us is the map for where this is headed, as Adam has detailed. What's your view on that,
sure.
Dave?
I mean, listen, I'm an organizer at heart. I'm a grassroots organizer. That's what I do. I look at systems of injustice, and then I try to find an equation, either a political equation, an organizing equation, or an economic focal point. And then you try to rebalance the injustice, the equation of injustice, towards a more just system. I think that's what Adam and I, with all the organizers that I know, that's kind of how we look at the food movement, as really a focal point to try to create important environmental changes, to try to revert. Agriculture can be a real amazing opportunity for farmers to participate actively as to reversing climate change, either through soil sequestration, carbon sequestration, renewing the soils. I would just say, when I look at this system with the trade agreements, if they pass, it would be a tragedy. It'll be, but it'll be an opportunity. Though a lot of people, the industry is really overplaying its hands. They are growing desperate because they recognize that there is massive globalizing resistance to these unjust, unfair, and undemocratic trade agreements and the huge and negative consequences that they have. I would just say, from my experience, you talk about the ballot initiative, you talk about the GMO labeling movement. We have mobilized for 20 years. Americans have been denied, more than 20 years, the right to know what's in their food, because chemical companies, biotech companies like Monsanto and DuPont, wrote the rules 22 years ago that deny us the right to know what's in our food. These trade agreements are basically what I call the Global Monsanto Protection Act. It is carte blanche protection for continued outsourcing of pollution. And I just want to say, if they want to outsource our jobs, if they want to globalize and profitize and basically extract all the natural resources from third world countries around the planet, and they want to continue to pollute them, we are going to globalize the revolution. We are going to continue to fight this, and we're not going to back down. And I would just say, already the food movement has had huge and massive gains. I mean, McDonald's sales are declining rapidly. That's because people are connecting the dots between pink slime and an unhealthy food system. And Adam mentioned about America, through these trade agreements, we are going to export one of the most dangerous food systems ever known to man. That is the standard westernized diet. 60% of Americans are obese or overweight. That is a catastrophic financial burden that we are outsourcing to these foreign countries. But the American government, we pay lip service to it with, the Let's Move campaign from the White House. Unfortunately, Barack Obama has never had the courage to stare down and stand up to Monsanto or these global corporations and the negative impacts that they're having on the environment. Ultimately, as Adam said earlier, he has sold us out at every turn. And I think one of the great tragedies of this this conversation, this debate that we're trying to have over trade and international trade agreements here in the U.S., is Barack Obama showed his true colors, showed his true character when he started attacking fellow Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, and he went after Democrats. And the other thing is even worse, is two Obama staffers, former staffers, have set up an AstroTurf campaign where they are pretending to be progressives for trade. I'm not sure if you've heard about that.
No, Adam, tell us sure about that. Tell us about that.
Well, Mitch Stewart was involved. He was the executive director for Obama for America, which was basically that the fake front group for Obama. And what they're trying to do is they've set up this new, he ran Organizing for America, and then Linda Tran is a former OFA press secretary. They're setting up with 270 Strategies, which is a firm that was started with Jeremy Bird, another Obama, former Obama staffer, and they're setting up a progressive group to pretend that there's progressives supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I mean, it's pretty emerging. It's pretty amazing that they would do this. And they are attacking progressives behind the scenes, and they're feeding misinformation. They call it the Progressive Coalition for American Jobs. And that's how that's what they're trying to sell. And the hilarious thing is, Hillary's been very quiet about this fast track. She has basically gone under the radar and is nowhere to be seen. And Mitchell Stewart is described as a senior advisor to Ready for Hillary. And they are running right now behind the scenes this AstroTurf campaign in Washington, D.C., lying about how progressive Democrats are supporting the fast track and the trade agreement. And nothing could be further from the truth. I think between Jim O'Leary and the fast track, I've never seen more effective organizing in the last, 20 years that I've been involved in politics. The people, there's been a lot of organizations that have been working on this, and we've actually, we sent out alerts, probably 4 alerts in the last week and a half, and we have people that are outraged over this process. But as a Democrat, it's embarrassing that our sitting president would spend more time attacking fellow Democrats than he does the Republican Party.
Yes, and I just want to mention, when you speak about organizing and all, for listeners, there are basically two actions, that I would strongly urge you all to take in terms of, because we'll now segue and talk a little bit about what's going on over the next few weeks, which is the critical time for slowing and stalling these deals. And, but I first want to say, that what you can do two things. You can go to Food Democracy Now, and you can sign up for their alerts. And they are covering this issue. They're doing alerts. They're doing actions. You've been listening to Dave Murphy. Please sign up. The other thing you can do is regularly, on a daily basis, and really, I do it every day. It's kind of like brushing your teeth when you get into the habit of it. It's not something you want to do once. You want to do it over and over. You can go to, and I've been recommending it on the show, you go to www.stopfasttrack.com, and they will put you in touch with your senators and your congressional, your House representatives, and you can call all of them. They'll connect you to all of them on the phone. If you just go and enter your phone number, they'll call you, and then they'll call your representatives, and you can speak to them and tell them, stop fast track. Please vote no on fast track. Commit to vote no on fast track, because fast track is the way they rush these deals with all the provisions we've been discussing on today's show past the public view and give the president, who you've heard unfortunately characterized in terms of his integrity around this issue today on the show, they give him an absolute authority to determine these deals and sign them without the provisions ever being fully known. And so the ones that we have talked about today come from past experience with the deals. They come from leaks around what some of the current and future worsening provisions will be. So the thing that we really, the way we'll stop this is by urging our representatives, especially your House representatives, because it likely will pass in the Senate, to vote no on fast track and call them every day. Your call counts. Over the next several weeks and months, coming now in May and into June, and Adam can tell us just a little teeny bit more before we kind of come to the end of our show, about what's upcoming. The point is to talk to your House member and tell them to vote no. At this point, Adam, it's true, isn't it, that, and it's at, www.stopfasttrack.com, as well as new information coming out all the time from Food Democracy Now at www.fooddemocracynow.com, and there will also be actions there. If you have foodie friends, pass the Food Democracy links along to them as well. And, for environmental and other, let people know so that they can take action and get involved as people become more and more informed about this. So, Adam, just very quickly, like just a minute or so, what are, we've already had a situation where the Senate, as we, conduct this show, is poised to vote fast track in, and then the action will move to the House. Is that correct?
That's right. And in the House, the Republican leadership admits that they still don't have the votes to pass fast track. And that means that we just need to make sure that we hold the votes there and let our elected officials know that we do not want them to vote for fast track, that we are that let them, for all the reasons that we've talked about today and for so many more, that we urge them to vote against fast track. This fast track will be in effect for 6 years. So it's not even just the agreements we've talked about. It's any agreements that any future administration might want to cook up with all the horrors that would go into those agreements that we can't even imagine yet. So we should not be giving this kind of power for the agreements that we already know about, and certainly not for whatever the next administration will be and whatever agreements they cook up. Fast track is a bad way to deal with trade. It's a bad way to deal with legislation in general. Congress should be able to do its job, read and study the legislation it's going to pass on its own timeline, amend it as needed, have the full amount of debate that it deems appropriate, not have legislation sent to Congress railroaded by the executive branch based on secretly negotiated trade deals.
Thank you. This has been an absolutely terrific show. I urge listeners, go to the Connect the Dot archives on PRN.fm and listen to some of the past shows to fully inform yourself further with Dave Murphy and Adam Weissman, our guests today on Connect the Dots. Final words from you, Dave, before we sign off for this week's show.
Yeah, I want to thank you for having me on the show, and I want to thank Adam for all his great work organizing. There have been a lot of really heroic organizing efforts around to raise awareness on this issue. This is the end of representative democracy if these two the trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then the European basically version of this pass, and we have to do everything that we can to mobilize. And here's the thing: if they get fast track, we have to commit to another 6 years of organizing to stop these trade agreements. We have to remove and abolish parasitic corporate protection provisions like the investor-state dispute settlement provision. We no longer can have corporations running roughshod over representative democracy, whether it's here in the United States or abroad. It's outrageous that American corporations, global corporations, pesticide companies, oil companies can go in and contaminate and pollute the environment and poison citizens of another country, and then these secret trade agreements that are passed can protect them. They should have the full weight of justice delivered in those countries and here in the U.S. I would just say we will be launching major boycotts, and we'll be asking for global boycotts of serious brands that not only support these trade agreements, but also that take advantage of those parasitic clauses like the investor state dispute settlement provision. So we're very encouraged by the progress that we've made in organizing about this. And we think long-term we can defeat it. It's just a question of waking the American people up and citizens around the world and just letting them know what their government's doing behind their back.
An opportunity for people to take action immediately. The 23rd is the March Against Monsanto in many places. Great opportunity to let people know that President Obama negotiated Islam Siddiqui, a former lobbyist for Monsanto's industry group, to be the chief agriculture negotiator for trade agreements, to talk to people about many of the issues that we've talked about here, to talk about the broken promises of these trade agreements, how deals like TPP are not maintaining the so-called high environmental standards that President Obama promised would be in these deals. We need to get the word out to more people and tell them to call their elected officials while there's still time.
That sounds great. One more thing. I just want to say, as you're hearing here, listeners, this is a turning point. And so, if we seize this moment, if we take action in the way that Dave Murphy of Food Democracy Now and Adam Weissman of Trade Justice Metro New York have been counseling on this today's program, then we can actually build a coalition that not only opposes these treaties, but that sets our whole country on a much better course where we're not always on the defensive. But even so, there's much more that people can and will need to be doing. So the earlier you get involved, the sooner you intervene, the more you join forces and tell others to do so, the better leverage we all have. And so I urge you to inform yourselves, pass the word around, tell others. And I thank both our guests as well as you listeners for being with us today on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and we're going to be covering this issue until we bury these treaties and fast track. Stay tuned. Let other people know. Thank you for being with us. Thank you both so much, Dave and Adam, for your fabulous work and your inspiration and information today. Have a great week, everyone. I'm Allison Rose Levy for Connect the Dots.
Well, thank you. And if your listeners want to learn more, they can check out tradejustice.net and gjae.org for more information.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Adam. Have a great week, everyone.